Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Have you gotten robocalls or mail saying that you're pre-approved for loans or credit cards? Well, if you have, thieves, both foreign and domestic, may have you in their sights. And it's the equity in the home that they... And it's the equity in your home that they want. It's called home title fraud, and it's one of the fastest growing crimes. Thieves are after your money, and they get it by forging your home's title. So it looks like you sold your home. Then they'll take out loans against your home and stick you with the payments. Ugh. No insurance, bank, or identity theft program protects you, but Home Title Lock does. For pennies a day, Home Title Lock puts a barrier around your home's online title and mortgage to keep thieves away. Again, if you've received robocalls or mail for pre-approved credit cards or loans, you need to move fast. You can receive 60 free days of risk-free Home Title Lock protection now by going to HomeTitleLock.com. Register your address to verify you're not already a victim. Go to HomeTitleLock.com. That's HomeTitleLock.com.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
I'm at the foot of the ladder. The lamb footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Ground mass is very fine. I'm going to step off the lamb now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
It is hard to believe. 50 years ago, this month, the Apollo 11 mission was successful. Americans on the moon. I was just out of kindergarten, and I remember it was the biggest event. Like, it was the biggest television event that I can remember as a child.
What that was like? I can't think of anything in my lifetime
now,
that approaches
and a little black and white television. And you're seeing the pictures on TV as a child. You're thinking, wait a second, that thing we look up in the sky at night, that's what. And when I was little, I remember looking up, seeing, can you see the men on the moon? Like, when you're little, you just think, wait, he's up. Do you think they're looking down at us now? And it was just such a period of even with all the, you know, the anti-war protests and Summer of Love. And then it was after, of course, the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy and all the things that were happening on the streets, the riots in D.C. This was a moment that our nation came together in wonderment of what was possible when we put American ingenuity, engineering, these team efforts at NASA were just amazing. And similarly, when you think about it, it was also, you know, rather disheartening, depressing even, when America seemed to be giving up space, where NASA was, you know, obviously we retired the space shuttles, and instead we were relying on private companies or other countries to launch our research into space and even our personnel. And that also became a depressing moment in our history in recent times. And of course, we fell on economic hard times. And it was budget cuts, and it was, I mean, this is what happens when you don't have periods of peace and prosperity, where you don't focus on America first, meaning we need to take care of ourselves, our engineering, our know-how, our advancement, our quest for knowledge. And when we do that, we're better off for everybody, for our people, for the rest of the world. And I think that it's a good thing to remember now, as President Trump has said, you know, we're not giving this up. We're going to be back in space in a big way. And this is something he addressed on the 4th of July.
Exactly 50 years ago this month, the world watched in awe as Apollo 11 astronauts launched into space with a wake of fire and nerves of steel and planted our great American flag on the face of the moon. Half a century later, we are thrilled to have here tonight the famed NASA flight director who led mission control during that historic endeavor, the renowned Gene Kranz. Gene, I want you to know that we're going to be back on the moon very soon, and someday soon we will plant the American flag on Mars. It's happening, Gene. It's happening.
And I want to thank all of our sponsors who are supporting this show and this podcast, of course, helping make it available free to you every week. GenuCell, ADT Home Security, and Home Title Lock. We don't stop at the moon. We go beyond the moon into the next frontier of space. Joining us now is to mark this incredible month of discovery as we look forward to the future is Holly Riding. She's the NASA Chief Flight Director. And just a huge moment for NASA, and I think so many people are just excited about what's to come. Holly, it's great to have you on. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
What does this mean, this 50th anniversary, as a point of reflection and perhaps a launching point for future NASA missions?
Well, I think you described it really aptly. First of all, the reflection is very important, right? I mean, one of the phrases that we use when we talk about, the team that got us to the moon is that we stand on the shoulders of giants, right? And those people, the astronauts, you know, the flight directors, the flight controllers, the entire team, you know, really are giants to us, right? But along with the reflection, it's also exciting because now we're having the opportunity in our careers to be those giants for the next generation. That's now our responsibility. And, you know, that's just really an amazing honor and opportunity.
Will you explain to our podcast listeners across the globe what being a flight director means? And we remember all the, you know, the classic archival footage of the of all the engineers and all the flight personnel on the ground and at the Space Center, and they're doing they're like hand calculations by hand, and they're charting it out with pencils and pens. So what does a flight director do today?
Well, the most important job of a flight director is the safety of our crews that are on orbit, right? So that's the number one thing to remember. How we do that task is things like you saw. We have a team of folks who are experts in all of the different systems of the spacecraft, including the human systems. And so those systems require different things. Sometimes it's math or trajectory. You know, we have power systems, communication systems. But at a very fundamental level, the flight director is the leader of the team responsible for the safety of the astronauts or crew members. And then after that, obviously, the safety of the space vehicle they're flying in. And thirdly, the success of the mission that we've been charged with.
I mean, are you the first female flight director in the history of NASA?
Yes, I am.
That's amazing. Oh, my gosh.
Well,
that is such a congratulations just on that. That is so incredible and so inspiring to young girls across the country and across the globe. Tell us how you and your own personal trajectory and school and so forth, how did you get to this place? What did you study? What did you immediately find yourself drawn to and talented for?
Well, I mean, I've been interested in space since I was really young. One of the things I love to do is just solve complex problems. So, you know, as a young student coming up, space has got a lot of complex problems. And I arrived at NASA. I was drawn to operations. I enjoy communicating and working with people. And that's kind of the place where the people aspects merge, you know, with all of the technical aspects. I was selected as a flight director and, you know, kind of worked my way through the system, had a bunch of opportunities. You know, NASA is amazing from the perspective of diversity. And so me personally, you know, always had opportunities that really came with, you know, as hard as I wanted to work and as much, you know, grit and effort as I wanted to put in. And then about a year ago, I was honored to be selected as the first female chief flight director.
Oh, my gosh. You like to solve complex problems, okay? I can't imagine, I couldn't as a child, watching Apollo 11. Again, on our tiny little black and white television in Glastonbury, Connecticut, we're like huddled around. You can't conceive, as just a person who's maybe not the greatest at math, or you're not, like, I remember physics and calculus, and I have a cold sweat right now, actually just remembering studying them. So here you all are there. Okay. You know, the speed that the vehicle will travel in, and when the boosters drop and the panels, and we can't have it melt. I mean, how many people, I know these seem like really dumb questions, but these are the questions that I come into my head about this. How many people does it take to get a complex NASA mission off the ground from start to finish? If you had to, like, just ballpark it, how many people?
You know, it's a good question, right? Because when you consider, you know, how many people we support in America through the various contracts we have, and if you added all of those
up,
all of the people who, you know, build the nuts and bolts that then get, you know, assembled into the spacecraft, I mean, you're tens of thousands of people that you affect their lives. If you want to think about, you know, launching the spacecraft or the folks who are sitting in mission control, we often are taking care of the space station with, you know, just a dozen or fewer people. So you got to think about how you want to answer that question. But at a fundamental level, space as an industry, space as a human endeavor, you know, touches, you know, so many human lives here in the United States and then also across the world.
Gene Kranz, of course, who is a legendary, you know, flight director, he said he was being asked about his vision and the learning process. And you could hear some music in the background of this soundbite, but this was from an interview he did with Smithsonian back in, I guess it was just last month. I thought it was earlier this year, but it was last month. Let's listen.
Failure is an ingredient in life. It's an ingredient in growing. Probably the worst failure of my life and our lives as mission controllers is when we lost our crew in the Apollo 1 fire. And we lived with that failure, and what we did about it, though, became very important. We sat and established a set of values, a set of standards that we would all live up to. They were expectations for ourselves and for others. Failure is an incredible, intense learning process. And if you use it as a learning process, it was worthwhile.
The annoying music notwithstanding in that clip, that has to be always on your mind. There are human beings involved, and the world is watching. How much pressure does that add to the situation?
So you're exactly right. I mean, there is a tremendous amount of pressure with the lives of our crew members, you know, in our hands. And you know, Gene is quoted talking about failure is not an option, and that's in our DNA today, right? We have the type of people who want to solve problems, who really want to be, you know, in the hot seat, making the decision when it needs to be made. If you were doing a sports analogy, you'd say, you know, you're the type of person that wants the ball when the game is on the line. And, you know, it's very stressful, but we have an amazing training program that helps us, you know what to do in the right cases. And then we have to, you know, find the right folks who really, when you get outside of your training, have that ability to still, you know, figure out what's the right thing to do for the crew members and the mission. We call that risk management. And it's been passed down to us. You know, I mentioned at the beginning on the shoulders of giants, Gene Kranz is one of those giants. And so that's our DNA today. And it's partially my responsibility to maintain that DNA and pass it along.
Holly, this is just such an amazing moment for the country, for NASA, for what lies next. And before we let you go, what do you hope for out of NASA and the United States? Let's just, over the next decade, what can we expect?
Well, you know, we started out with talking about reflection, but the word I like to use is excitement, right? So many people remember Apollo, but my generation and our NASA administrator, Jim Bridenstine, has talked about this. We remember, you know, Challenger, and we remember Columbia, yep. and weren't alive when Apollo happened. And so, you know, to have the opportunity to get to the moon in 2024, the first woman on the moon, the next man on the moon, and the excitement that goes with that. Sure, it's a tremendous amount of responsibility, but, you know, we get to fly spaceships out of low Earth orbit, you know, to the moon and then beyond to Mars. And, you know, you just couldn't ask for a better opportunity. And we need to make sure that we provide that, you know, to the people today and then the generations behind us, because, you know, we should never underestimate the power of that dream and the impact that it's going to make. And we're going to do it. Moon 2024. We're excited.
Oh, my gosh. We are so thrilled. Holly Riding, NASA Chief Flight Director, historic moment for NASA, for the country, and led by the first woman chief flight director, which I think is so, I mean, that's important for so many reasons. We need more young women going into STEM and engineering and technical fields all across the board, because they're great leaders. And inherently, I think women are problem solvers. We have to be. And, Holly, you obviously are in a big, big way. Thank you so much, Holly, for joining us. We really appreciate it.
I'm glad to be a role model, and thank you so much for having me and letting me share it with everyone.
Absolutely. Holly Riding here on the Laura Ingram Podcast. Have you gotten robocalls or mail saying that you're pre-approved for loans or credit cards? Well, if you have, thieves, both foreign and domestic, may have you in their sights. And it's the equity in the home that they... And it's the equity in your home that they want. It's called home title fraud, and it's one of the fastest growing crimes. Thieves are after your money, and they get it by forging your home's title. So it looks like you sold your home. Then they'll take out loans against your home and stick you with the payments. Oh, no insurance, bank, or identity theft program protects you, but Home Title Lock does. For pennies a day, Home Title Lock puts a barrier around your home's online title and mortgage to keep thieves away. Again, if you've received robocalls or mail for pre-approved credit cards or loans, you need to move fast. You can receive 60 free days of risk-free Home Title Lock protection now by going to HomeTitleLock.com. Register your address to verify you're not already a victim. Go to HomeTitleLock.com. That's HomeTitleLock.com.
But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win. And the others, too.
Well, of course, JFK was, you know, reaching for the stars, literally. And it was tied into this sense, I think, in the early 1960s of America, the best, the strongest, unafraid. We're the smartest, and we're going to show everybody, and we're going to do it because it's hard. Think about today, how... So many that get a lot of airtime on TV and politics and the culture, they do the easy thing to get attention, to get promoted, to make a buck, but the easy way out. We have a lot of people who take the easy path, sue someone to get money, because you can. You can make a charge against someone. It's easier than making an argument. Right. You can come to the country illegally. Well, it's not easy to get up to the border. But once you're in, you don't have to go through all the nonsense of applying for, you know, legal status. Do even that. I mean, it's not easy, but it's not the right thing. And it was the right thing and the hard thing to go to the moon. It was right for science and research and discovery. But it was also... It was hard, obviously. It's beyond obvious. But it also tests us as people, and it affirms our sense of patriotism, our love of country, our love of achievement. And again, getting back to merit, where it doesn't matter where you came from or your skin color or your ethnicity. None of that matters. As long as you follow the rules, want to be American, contribute, love our country as much as we do. Doesn't mean you don't criticize leadership. Yeah, I'm not saying that. But you love the country, love the fundamental tenets of this country. That's what it's all about. That's where we are. And I think that's what we're slowly getting back to, where that sense of patriotism, it's right out in front of us. And we're not going to allow it to be put on trial, our patriotism. No way. In fact, we're going to challenge those who don't seem to love the founding ideals of our country. Our founders, everyone's imperfect. They were imperfect, but genius. A genius after a genius after a genius. against all odds, broke free from the bonds of tyranny from Britain and ultimately established the government that would organize and set off the most incredible experiment in representative democracy the world has ever seen. That's an amazing thing. Again, doesn't mean there wasn't some bad things that happened. Very bad things happened. But overall, and without a doubt, the greatest country in the face of the earth from the start, where people believed we would fall quickly. There's no way a representative democracy organized under the principles of federalism and the states' rights argument versus the federal government and all these different visions coming from Hamilton to Jefferson, led by Washington and Madison. And there was no way they were going to hold together this diverse group of people from these different parts of this new land, this new country. The Virginians didn't agree with the Connecticut folks, and the Massachusetts folks didn't agree with the folks in Maryland. But we figured it out. This sense of patriotism that we should be proud of who we are. And I think going back in a big way into space is important for our national psyche, our advancement, our young people who can strive to greater things as well. And I just go back to this. I go back to this understanding in my own way of the genius of the men and women of NASA. I mean, the minds and the ability to see what none of us, just mere academic mortals, can see. I mean, total brainiacs. I'm so fascinated by just that level of intelligence and the vision it takes to think not only can we send a rover to Mars, take a long time to get there. Once it gets there, we're going to be able to control it from Houston. They're controlling it every day. The Mars rover, you can go online and watch what it's discovering. It goes over little bumps. I mean, I met one of the guys who actually did the Mars rover project on a plane once. I talked to him for 3 hours. He was really fascinating, a really geeky guy, but it was just like quintessential NASA engineer. And he was showing me all these photos. I was like, that is really cool. And I'll go back to my politics job. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Dr. Bill Barry is NASA's chief historian. And wow, who better to talk to at a big moment in the reflection of our 50-year history with Apollo 11 than Dr. Barry. Dr. Barry, great to talk to you. How are you, sir?
I am great, Laura. How are you doing?
I'm fantastic. I'm just in awe. You know, I talked to NASA's chief flight director, Holly Riding. We just got finished with that interview, and she was just inspiring.
Isn't she great?
Oh my gosh. What? I mean, she's so humble, and this is what I love. The people who don't have a right to brag are all over Washington and all over social media, and they're bragging about stuff that, you know, you got to be kidding me. And then the people who are actually doing the most amazing things in society, as philanthropically or volunteer-wise, or in the case of the great achievers at NASA, you know, you don't even know their names, but there they are doing the work every day.
That's one of the great pleasures of my job, is that I get to work with people who are changing the world as we speak, and they're just doing their job.
It's incredible. And I know you joined NASA in 2001, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yes, I had a career in the Air Force prior to that, and then when I retired from the Air Force, I was lucky enough to land my dream job working at NASA. So,
And how did you make that transition, though? Because were you a pilot? You were a pilot in the Air Force, and then when you retire, I don't usually think of people retiring and then going to NASA. you decided to go from Air Force, flying planes, and then ending up as a historian at NASA ultimately.
Well, it's a long story, and it starts back probably in 1962 with John Glenn. And my first memory of anything is watching John Glenn's flight on TV. Mm-hmm. And I was inspired from that point to be, you know, work for NASA and be an astronaut, I hoped. But computer science and I did not get along really well. So when I was in college, I was at the Air Force Academy. I discovered that being an engineer was not going to be my forte. But I went on into the Air Force, and I spent about half my Air Force career flying KC-135 air refueling tankers.
Oh, yeah.
And a great airplane. And then I spent about the other half of my Air Force career teaching at the Air Force Academy. And in the course of doing that, the Air Force very nicely sent me off for graduate school education. And I did my doctoral dissertation on basically a political history of the early Soviet human spaceflight program. Mm. And that's what lined me up to come work for NASA.
You know what I remember from my Russian study days? Sokol, ya Berkut, vy menya slyshite, da slyshu. It was just like Sokol, the Berkut. Remember from the? I mean, it's just like that was one of our early dialogues in Russian. We first started taking Russian. It's hilarious.
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually wound up studying Russian in junior high school. I actually had school earlier. Yeah, no kidding.
So did I. Давайте говорите по-русски или нет?
Немножко. I'm out of practice these days, but
That's okay. Those are the days.
The funny thing is that I wound up in Russian because I hated my French teacher that I had in sixth grade, That decision in seventh grade made all the difference in my life in terms of the path that I wound up following. But it's been interesting.
Now, have you ever named a dog Laika since you decided? No one knows what we're talking about, by the way, but that's the dog that the Russians sent up in space called Laika.
The first dog in space, on Sputnik 2. No, I haven't ever named one of our dogs Laika, but I've been tempted, and my wife has very wisely advised me not to do that.
Okay, so let's talk about this 50-year anniversary and the importance of NASA in this moment. And our overall sense of pride in country, which I think a lot of us think is taking a hit in recent times, and for a lot of reasons. There are a lot of people who find fault, a lot of fault with the United States, a lot of fault with our founders, a lot of fault with our music or our symbols or statues, or there's a lot of whipped up anger out there. But the Apollo is a rallying point. The Apollo missions and the missions that followed. We're for the most part a rallying point for the nation, and I think it's just so important that we not only remember, but that we continue to rally the country behind the reaching into this other world of space.
Yeah, Apollo was really a transcendent moment for the United States and for human history. I mean, really, it's the first time we set foot on the moon. 500 years from now, who will people remember from the 20th century? I think the list of names will include Neil Armstrong, just like we remember Christopher Columbus from 500 years ago. So I think it's a huge thing, not just for U.S. history, but for humanity.
I remember the interview that Armstrong gave some years back with Ed Bradley on 60 Minutes, where that notion of humility really came to the fore. Let's listen.
You sometimes seem uncomfortable with your celebrity, that you'd rather not have all of this attention.
No, I just don't deserve it.
But look, how many people have walked on the moon? 12? You were the first. You were chosen to do that. That's special.
Yeah, I wasn't chosen to be first. I was just chosen to command that flight. Circumstance put me in that particular role. That wasn't planned by anyone.
Well, just that is so unusual to hear today from most people.
Yeah, Neil's of course an interesting guy, but I think it was great that he was the first the foot in the moon. I mean, we couldn't have picked a better guy. Several of his own colleague astronauts have said that about him in the past. But he actually is correct, though. I mean, we were incredibly lucky during the spring of 1969. There were three missions that had to go perfectly and for us to get on the moon in July 1969: Apollo 9, 10, and 11. And the fact that they all went well, and we wound up landing on our first attempt with Apollo 11, really is was a circumstance that I think most people at NASA would have been betting against, because we knew the odds were stacked against everything going so well. But now, it did, and Neil's the first.
I remember watching it, as I said earlier, on this little black and white television in our house, and we were all huddled around. I don't think anyone spoke. Everyone was like holding their breath. It was before reality TV or cable TV, or it was just everyone was watching all of America. That doesn't happen anymore. I don't care if it's Super Bowl or World Cup. Those moments don't happen anymore for the most part. Maybe 9/11 but that moment where everybody was watching and there was no question, we were all rooting for the same thing. And that in and of itself is important.
Yeah, our estimate is that 650 million people on planet Earth watched the moon landing live on TV, which, you know, it's only about 20%, but when you consider that large swaths of the planet blacked it out, like the communist China didn't carry the coverage, it wasn't carried in the Soviet Union either, or in the Eastern Bloc, so large parts of the world couldn't possibly see it anyway, so a big chunk, and over half of Americans were watching the show live. I was one of those kids who's sitting on the floor, you know, crouched up in front of our TV, and the only noise we heard in our house was, "Bill, get back away from the TV so the rest of us can watch."
That's hilarious. By the way, I just read this. You might have seen this. Neil Armstrong's gold medal that flew to the moon sold for more than $2 million. Oh my gosh! I guess that just happened. I mean, it just broke on Fox News 52 minutes ago. Wow.
I haven't seen it yet, but I'm not surprised. There's a very big market in collectibles from the Apollo program because everybody, you know, loves the Apollo program and they all want a piece of it. I mean, we all own a piece of it. We paid for it through our tax dollars and many other people pay for it through, you know, years of their life and investment and effort and energy and blood, sweat, and tears. But everybody, you know, wants a little talisman to remember it by.
Wow. And on the question of history, the USSR was originally ahead of us, as we noted with the dog up in space and so forth. How did we beat them? How did it happen?
Well, this is the brilliance of President Kennedy's decision to race to the moon. You know, the Soviets were ahead largely because they had a much bigger booster rocket than we had. And they had that because they had a much larger design for their nuclear warhead, so they built that rocket originally as an intercontinental ballistic missile, and then they were able to use it for space launches, and it was big, so it could carry a lot of things. And they had a very small team of very clever engineers who were watching what we were doing and finding things that they could do ahead of us. So they gave the appearance that they were way ahead. Were they really ahead? That's another question. But nonetheless, President Kennedy recognized that that big booster was the problem. And folks from NASA advised them, you know, if we set up a fair fight where they have to build a new booster rocket to get a human to the moon, and we have to build a booster rocket to get a human to the moon, that'd be a fair fight. We think we're going to win it, and so that's how the Apollo program started. And the Soviets, actually, interestingly enough, they didn't take Kennedy's challenge seriously in 1961. It wasn't until 1964, when we actually had a booster rocket that was bigger than theirs, that they decided, oh, the United States is actually serious about this. And then they started a crash program to try and beat us to the moon. And they almost won. They had a robot they sent to the moon at the last minute, and it crashed on the moon while Neil and Buzz were on the moon. It was called Luna 15. If it had been successful, they would have been able to bring back a sample about the same time that we got back with our samples.
Wow. And again, the brain power, the vision, obviously the money, it costs to do this is today just, it's always been hard for me to contemplate. But they're visionaries in everything. You know, President Kennedy was a visionary in stating the importance of this and committing the nation to it. But the engineers, the people who are the unsung heroes of NASA, those people who were up night after night after night for years doing the calculations that we didn't have computers to do to make this, you know, this Apollo 11 mission a success, and obviously learning from the Apollo 1 disaster. I mean, it's actually hard still to contemplate all these years later with all our advancement in supercomputing and AI and everything else. It still takes a person to have the vision initially and then back then to do all the incredibly complex calculations to make this all happen.
Yeah, there were about 400,000 people who worked on the Apollo program overall to make it work. And what's amazing to me, you know, looking at it from a leadership perspective, as well as historical perspective, but we were incredibly lucky in having some really brilliant leaders who came to NASA from the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics when it turned into NASA in 1958, and some other people that came into NASA as NASA was growing in the early 60s. And the leadership was technically competent, but they also recognized that they needed to let the people that worked for them run, and they hired a lot of really young people. You know, so, mm-hmm. If you look at those pictures of Mission Control, those guys are all in their 20s.
That's amazing.
And they trusted those guys to do their job and do it well. And people were highly motivated not to disappoint the leaders who had such faith in them. So, there's this virtuous circle there that happened where we had great leaders, great people work for them, and they reinforced each other. And I think that's a critical component to
putting together a team. I'm always fascinated by team dynamics, whether it's sports or good business teams, innovators, and the management of that team of people. A lot of the kids came out of MIT, right, and other incredible mm-hmm. institutions of learning, PhDs, young PhDs, but to manage all the different types of talents that had to be in that mission control at one time, that was stunning, and it continues to be stunning.
Yeah, if you listen to the tapes the power descent and landing on Apollo 11, Gene Kranz is like the master orchestrator. He's the conductor who's leading a team who's just on their game and sharp, and they know what they're doing. And it's a thing of beauty just to listen to that, those conversations. Problems come up and they identify them, they solve them, and they move on. And it's just amazing.
Why is it important for us to go back to the moon? That's just a question that a lot of regular folks would like to understand.
Well, of course, I'm a historian, so I'll take a philosophical perspective. I think it's human destiny that we will move beyond planet Earth and move out into the solar system. And the moon is the obvious next stepping stone to get out there. We learned how to fly to the moon and operate there during the 1960s and 70s. But that expertise, those young guys that were in the mission control in the 60s, they're in their 70s and 80s now, and they're not going to come back and do this mission for us. So we need to train a whole new generation on how we're going to get out to the moon and then on to Mars. So the moon's a good training ground to do that, and I think that's the next logical step. And I think the president's policy to get us to the moon and prepare for Mars is a wise step.
So moon will be the base of operations for the Mars operation? Is that how it works?
My understanding is that we'll go to the moon, we'll train on how to do things there. The actual how we fly from Earth to Mars, I'm not sure that answer is completely baked yet. I suspect there'll be some combination of things that'll happen. That mission could launch from Earth orbit. It could launch from the gateway around the moon or any number of places. So it'll sort of depend on how the technology gets us moving in the next decade or so.
Off topic. Back to your Air Force Academy experience.
Sure.
I ended one of my book tours at the Air Force Academy. This was probably 7 years ago. I had such a great time there in Colorado Springs. I had never been there. I'd been to West Point and to the Naval Academy many times, but I'd never been there. What a great group of people! I got to speak to the cadets in the mm-hmm. Mess hall. And what do they get to eat? Like 4 minutes they get to eat or something? They get no time to eat. Yeah, so they said, well, you can speak for 60 seconds. I got up and I said, all right, guys, I was just in your, what do you call it, the barracks? I don't know what you call it. Where they live. Is it called the barracks?
One of the dorms?
Yeah, dorms. I just went through your dorms. You're all out of Sammy. And meaning what? That's your out of your inspection. That's something with, it's an acronym for inspection. You're all out of Sammy. We're doing an 80-pound run this afternoon, 80-pound packs. Get your stuff together. And it was, I just was so deadpan. The whole place, like 5,000 people, went silent. And I said, I'm just kidding. Come on. Like, just drop and give me 50, though, just for the heck of it. Oh, it was so funny. I loved it there. I had such a great time.
It is a great institution, and it's made all the difference in my life, you know, sending me on a path that's led me right to here at Bassett.
No, it's amazing. That's amazing. When you read, and I'll let you go after this, when you read these ridiculous conspiracy theories that the moon landing didn't happen, you know, as the chief historian for NASA, what goes through your mind?
I have to chuckle mostly. To me, the biggest problem with the conspiracy theories is that we were in a race to the moon against the Soviets, and they would have outed us in a second if we tried to fake it. So there's no way it would have happened anyway. But to me, I often wonder, you know, what are these people who are convinced moon hoaxers? What are they going to tell their grandchildren when they're out there visiting the Apollo 11 lunar landing site on the moon at the park we're going to have up there someday, I suppose? How are they going to explain their social media posts from, you know, the 20 years before to their grandkids? I think it'd be pretty embarrassed.
It's completely embarrassing. Thank you so much. And we just love hearing the stories and also just your expertise, Dr. Bill Berry, and your service to this country in the Air Force as well. Just so impressive. And happy 50th anniversary of Apollo 11. Thank you so much, Dr. Berry. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Laura. It's been my pleasure.
All right. You take care. And I want to remind everybody who's been listening to this podcast about the great skincare products that our friends at Chamonix, they put together with incredible compounds. And one that you guys seem to just love, and I'm so happy about it, is the Genucel's amazing, amazing new jawline treatment. Now, a jawline, your neck, it's kind of sensitive skin. You want the MDL technology, the proprietary base, the brand new treatment that helps get your skin back to looking tighter, healthier, younger looking. Cheryl from Fort Wayne, Indiana loves it. She said she's been using it for a week. She says the results are visible and her jawline looks so much better, even younger. Smiley face. All right, well, love it. Keep sending us all of these comments, and I love to read them, and I'll continue to share them with all of you out there. Remember, it's just genucel.com. That's GENUCEL.com. You get 100% of your money back, no questions asked, if you don't like the results, but you will, I'm telling you. But it's a great deal and just great guarantee. So you order now, and you get the Genucel for bags and puffiness, also free with your order, and also the Genucel immediate effects, also free. So there's no time but the present to get the best skin possible with the Genucel line of products. That's GENUCEL.com and two free gifts and express shipping at Genucel.com. All right, we're going to move on to other topics because there's a lot happening during the last 7 days. We've had the Democrat Party both start to eat itself from within, okay, cannibalize itself, then come together to expose all of them as essentially acolytes of what I call AOC plus three, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, Ayan Pressley, and Ilhan Omar. All freshman congresswomen. We don't care what skin color they are, where they come from. We focus on their ideas and their vision for this country, what they actually think about the founding of this country. But they have all the Democrats quaking in their boots, rushing to defend them against these bogus charges of racism used as a club to try to smash Trump and his supporters with. But I don't think it's working. I think it's defining the Democrat Party today in a radical new way. So this is what Ilhan Omar said on Rachel Maddow's show about the president and part of what he talked about yesterday.
He's called on us to go back and fight corruption and fight these countries that have worst leaders and inept leaders. Well, we are living in one. He is that president. He is corrupt. He is the worst president we've had. He is inept. And we're going to call him out for it.
Well, and not only she said that, But then she went on at the Netroots convention and said this.
Something that I get criticized for all the time. It's not what you think, so don't, like, don't gasp. It is that, like, I am anti-American because I criticize the United States. And I believe, as an immigrant, I probably love this country more than anyone that is naturally born.
Really? Joining us now. Delighted she's with us. Rahil Raza is the president of the Council for Muslims Facing Tomorrow, the author of the book, Their Jihad, Not My Jihad. And also she's in Washington promoting this fabulous new film, Kids Chasing Paradise, which we'll discuss in a moment. But she, we got such a great reaction to Rahil Raza on the Ingram angle on Fox that I wanted to chat with her for a longer period of time about this new dynamic of these very, very vocal and, well, attention-grabbing female Muslim congresswomen in Washington, D.C., and how that might portend other more radical movements to come in the United States. Rahil, it's great to have you on the podcast. Let's talk about this. Ilhan Omar argues that she is more pro-American, loves the country more than native-born Americans. Has that been borne out in her comments and her actions?
It certainly hasn't been borne out. I would say that she's a very good liar. Since the day she was elected, she has said, nothing that would prove that she loves America. She has been critical of the President of the United States of America. And these are the people who elected her, so the hypocrisy and the double standards and the lying. And she has a history of going back and forth. You know, she says things and then she retracts. And so how can one trust what she's saying? I mean, her actions and her words have proven beyond reasonable doubt that she hates the president and she hates the country. So when he invites her to leave, then she gets upset and plays the race card.
Yeah. And what is the agenda here? I mean, they've been very transparent about decriminalizing illegal immigration, Green New Deal. Most of them support one way or another some type of socialized medicine. They call it Medicare for All, which will just bankrupt Medicare very quickly. But what is their ultimate goal? Is it to transform the Democrat Party, blow it up, make America part of just a general global order so we shake the bonds of or the connection to the evil racist past? I mean, what do you see happening here?
You know, it's very complicated, but what I see is this push towards globalism and Islamism. And when I say Islamism, I'm talking about political Islam, which is an agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood. And the, you know, globalism is also something that they are pushing for. And it's very insidious. It's very dangerous. And they keep, Ilhan Omar keeps deflecting from the real issues of what she's talking about by constantly blaming someone else for what is happening. But I think that the Democratic Party needs to be very cognizant of the fact that this is a dangerous agenda. And in the work that I do with youth radicalization, I believe she is setting a very, very dangerous precedent for young people that it's okay to hate America, it's okay to hate the president, it's okay to insult him and abuse him. And not to mention that she has normalized anti-Semitism to a degree where it has become an everyday occurrence. You know, I clearly remember working in the field of trying to, expose the dangers of anti-Semitism the 20 years ago. It was still something of a shock to hear anti-Semitic remarks. That is no longer the case. It has become normalized by everyone. And everyone has jumped on the bandwagon because you have people in power, a congresswoman who holds responsibility. And if she can be anti-Semitic, so people feel that it's normal to do so.
Well, and they write it off as, oh, you're just, every time they're criticized, they say you're Islamophobic or racist or xenophobic. That's just their reflexive response, is it not, Rahil?
That is. It is this whole issue of Islamophobia, which is a term that is used to shut up any kind of criticism, to actually stifle free speech. And it is, again, a very dangerous tool that is used by the Islamists to stop us from criticizing and speaking out. So anyone who criticizes what any of these four women say will be called an Islamophobe, a racist, a bigot, because they're playing identity politics. And that is something that they shouldn't be doing, because in the world today, we already have the danger of this kind of rhetoric leading to hate, leading to radicalization, and then ultimately leading to violence. This documentary that we are showing, in that we show what is it that ultimately leads to violence. It's hate.
And we're talking to Raheel Reza, who's the author of the book, Their Jihad, Not My Jihad, and also is promoting this incredible film, Kids Chasing Paradise. Tell us about the film, why this is so important, and what we need to understand about the, again, tolerating political Islam in the United States, tolerating it, normalizing it, making ourselves numb to it, and how that could lead ultimately to really, really bad results.
This is a documentary that takes an unflinching look at the brutal exploitation of youth by extremists worldwide. And the reason this is important is because, according to the George W. Program on Extremism, investigations of connections with ISIS have been opened in all 50 states. There are 1,000 open investigations with 182 arrests having already been made, and 45% of the arrests are of people under 30. So we know from UN statistics that there are child soldiers fighting in the world. We know that ISIS has recruited thousands of young people, including Americans, Canadians, Europeans. And this radicalization of young people is an issue that has spilled over into the West. It is just not being addressed. So we are showing this film and accompanying this film. We have a workshop called PVE, which is Preventing Violent Extremism. And in this workshop, we talk about the factors that lead to youth radicalization and how we can prevent it before it happens.
And Raheel, I'm talking to a lot of friends in Europe who tend to be fairly liberal on social issues and so forth, and they didn't really care for Donald Trump for a whole bunch of reasons, and Swedish friends and friends in Norway. And I've got to say, my one Swedish friend who, she and I argue politely on text messages a lot about Trump, but she has seen her country transformed in many places, in many ways, by the misogynistic and oftentimes violent aspects of this radical view of Islam brought in by refugees, mostly from Syria, into Sweden. And the crime, the liberal leaders of Sweden making excuses, saying you can't publish people's ethnicity on Facebook who are perpetrators of horrible acts of violence against women. And now the Swedes are fed up. They're just fed up with this, but I wonder if it's just too late now for them. But they're starting to deport a lot of these people who are radicalized and spreading radicalization in throughout Sweden.
Well, I'm afraid it's too late for Sweden and for the rest of Europe, and in some ways for the UK. Now, I've been on educational tours to all these countries, and Sweden was the most concerning. It was a terrible state of affairs. There is a town in Sweden called Malmo where the police would rather resign than go in and do law enforcement because it is so dangerous. The Islamists have totally taken over. And I asked members of parliament in Sweden that you have such a wonderful country and so many resources and such great infrastructure, and why are you letting this happen? And I will never forget what they said. They said, we have too much. We have too good a thing and we want to share it. Well, the sharing has led to this situation where it's too late for them to turn back. They wanted to bring in ISIS fighters and accommodate them there, take the immigrants and the refugees that they have accepted into parts of the country where the Swedes have never seen a colored person before, and take over their hotels and their seniors' homes. So it has been a very, very traumatic situation. Then you look at the rape gangs in the UK. they were not mentioned in newspapers and law enforcement wouldn't do anything because they happened to be of a certain ethnic minority. They were Pakistani Muslims. And I am a Pakistani Muslim, and I can say that this was an atrocious thing that happened. But political correctness, the regressive left, the world we are living in today, and this label of Islamophobia has created an atmosphere in which people are terrified to speak out. So it becomes incumbent on Muslims like myself to be the frontline speakers and to talk about these issues, because we have to expose these problems. And if people like Ilhan Omar are not addressing problems within the Somali community, where female genital mutilation is rampant, where forced and underage marriage is happening, where young Somali boys are being recruited by Al-Shabaab, which is a terrorist extremist organization in Somalia. And I have met the Somali activists who have said we have this problem. What can we do about it? She is so concerned about constantly abusing Trump, the United States, and of course Israel, that she doesn't look at her own community.
No, it's and what's happened in to religious freedom. I'm reading about this patriarch of the Chaldean Catholic Church in Iraq, Louis Sacco. He's very worried about the Christians in Iraq. I mean, they've been just obviously pummeled, so many killed, and others just left after the U.S. Invasion in Iraq. They had 2 million Christians in Iraq, living peacefully, I might add, under Saddam Hussein, who kind of left them alone for the most part. But they've been decimated by the sectarian violence, driven out of their homelands.
Not just in Iraq, but in many parts
Syria,
of the world.
Syria?
They are the worst persecuted community. So let me ask you a question. The squad who calls themselves social justice warriors and are so concerned about the vulnerable, do they ever speak about the persecution of Christians in Muslim lands? Do they ever speak about the persecution of minorities? They don't. So where is their sense of social justice if they're only talking about one particular issue and one person, and they're not really looking at these larger issues of minority persecution, of religious persecution? I mean, social justice needs to be across the board. It can't be just for one person or against one person. So it's very transparent if the Democrats could only see through the facade and understand what the agenda is, and also a very dangerous trajectory.
Rahil Raza, thank you so much for joining us. These issues are not going away anytime soon, but we pray every day for our persecuted Christian brothers and sisters around the globe, in Jordan, in Syria, in Iraq, from the Nineveh Plains to the horrible conditions in some of these refugee camps, where Christians still are persecuted, and some now living in Europe who feel persecuted, Christians, because of the violence and crime brought by many of these refugee communities. And Europe's got to save itself now. We're not going to be able to save it. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast. I want to thank all of our sponsors again who are supporting this show: GenuCell, ADT Home Security, and Home Title Lock. Support them because they help provide this podcast free every week. The Laura Ingraham Podcast, America now and forever. We'll see you next time.